This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 8th of August, 2015, on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Daniel Giacopelli, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcasted right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily, and of course, The 10. Coming up, Moscow has laid claim to more than 450,000 square miles of the Arctic. We discuss the consequences as Russia isn't the only nation drawn to the region.
Stephen Harper doesn't want to look like he's giving away possible Canadian territory, obviously, to the Russians, but equally he needs to sort of play by the international rules that the other members of the Arctic Council are playing by too.
And as Rolling Stone magazine appoints a new managing editor, we ask how easy it is for a publication to turn a new page after bad publicity.
In this era now, with so many websites and people checking your journalism when you're writing for a magazine or a newspaper, it's very difficult to get away with the kind of errors that Rolling Stone, unfortunately, were perceived to have introduced into this article.
Also, North Korea creates itself a new time zone, and airline companies cease to carry trophy hunt shipments. All that and much more coming up in the next half hour, right here on The Recap with me, Daniel Giacopelli. We start this episode by taking a look at the situation facing Rolling Stone magazine. When an article was published featuring some questionable claims about an alleged rape at a university campus, the publication faced the most severe editorial crisis in its nearly half-century history. Last week, three graduates of the fraternity in question filed lawsuits against the magazine, its publisher, and a journalist. Publicly, at least, Rolling Stone is attempting to turn a new page, and it's hoped that the arrival of a new managing editor will help usher in a fresh start. But what lingering effects might the controversy have on the magazine's editorial approach? Well, on Monday's edition of The Briefing, Monocle's Marcus Hippie spoke to media correspondent for The Independent here in London, Adam Sherwin.
He's very much an insider from Wenner Media, the company owned by Jan Wenner, the Rolling Stone founder. He's currently the editor of Men's Journal, and so he knows how the company works. He also apparently plays tennis with Wenner's son, Gus, who is being brought very much to the fore in the business and is the head of digital operations. And it's being said that perhaps Gus is the person who may be driving things forward now.
How much is known about why Will Dana, the current or previous editor, is leaving? Is this campus story scandal the only reason, or has there been something else going on there as well?
It's clearly an attempt to draw a line under that scandal. He hung on for 9 months. His initial offer to resign was refused by Wenner. But now Wenner says that the whole magazine needs a shake-up. He sees this as an opportunity as well as a disaster that this story was. So I think this may well have a lot to do with other pressures behind the scenes at Rolling Stone, which has been under some financial pressure recently.
What kind of changes are you expecting to see now on the pages of the magazine?
Well, what Wenner says about the new editor find is that when he went to Men's Journal, he didn't rip everything up, but he made some gradual changes. So I think what we'll see over time is even more of a focus on the digital aspect of the magazine. But the first thing clearly will be to re-establish its integrity and its journalism, because that is what's really suffered. So I'm sure that there'll be some stricter editorial structures put in place when staff are going ahead with some of these big investigations.
Many observers have written about the lasting impact the campus story will have, not just on Rolling Stone, but journalism as a whole. What are your thoughts on this? What kind of lessons should we learn?
Well, there seems to be a trend at the moment. We've had NBC News and Brian Williams. We've had cases where Kate West stories have been apparently fabricated, and then people have had to walk the plank and new editors brought in. In this era now, with so many websites and people checking your journalism when you're writing for a magazine or a newspaper, it's very difficult to get away with the kind of errors that Rolling Stone, unfortunately, were perceived to have introduced into this article. So I think we're going to see a much stricter tone over investigations and people not being able to run away with stories simply because it sounds like a good idea. This Virginia case, yes, Rolling Stone was looking for a case to take forward because this was a very hot issue, sexual assault on campuses, and it obviously is a very serious issue. But the idea was then to kind of fit the facts to meet the story, and the usual checks were just abandoned.
Finally, before I let you go, could we go through maybe your top three tips on how Rolling Stone can leave this rather painful phase behind and how to get a new start?
I suppose the first thing has to be to apologise unreservedly for your error, and I think they're doing that. Then you have to make some changes. So this is the second part of that strategy with changing the editor. They're facing severe lawsuits from some of the people that feel that their reputations were damaged. So this is going to cost them a lot of money still. I suppose the third thing would be then to conduct a really good, solid investigation in the Rolling Stone tradition that people can get behind and say, you know what, they've learnt their mistakes from this now, and this is what we expect from Rolling Stone.
Are you expecting an apology?
I think they have said that the story was a huge failing. They went to the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism to conduct their own internal review, which is a very searching thing to do, and it completely pulled apart the fact that the journalists involved hadn't even gone to put the story to the people that were being accused in the article. So some very serious errors were made there. So yeah, things are going to have to change.
What is your feeling? How forgiving is the public? How easily can you restore the trust?
It can be done. We've seen the New York Times had a case of a young journalist who was found to have fabricated stories. The New Republic had the case as well. So these things do happen. It takes a while, but if you can prove that you've got rid of the problem, isolated it, and brought in some new standards and structures, then people can have confidence again.
That was media correspondent for the Independent newspaper here in London, Adam Sherwin, speaking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie on Monday's edition of The Briefing. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Let's continue now with a highlight from Tuesday's edition of Midori House. During recent days, it's been impossible to escape the news about Cecil, the Zimbabwean lion killed last month in debatably illegal circumstances by an American game hunter. Walter Palmer, the Minnesota dentist in question, may now face extradition proceedings from Zimbabwe and should probably give it another month before he looks at his Twitter replies. In the real world, however, the story has had real consequences. Three U.S. airlines have announced that they'll no longer carry big game trophies. This is what Andrew Muller's guests, Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Axel Threlfall, editor-at-large with Reuters, had to say about it.
You know, when you read these big, bold, dramatic statements from the airlines released by PR companies, you know, effective today, we will no longer carry the bodies or carcasses or heads of lions and tigers. Come on. I mean, this is PR. Why, you know, they should be ahead of the curve, these airlines. They shouldn't have been doing it anyway, right?
One would think not. And it is also worth pointing out, I did look into this. Apparently, most trophies are sent home by ship anyway. So we can look forward, doubtless, to another wave of publicity hunting from the shipping companies, which again is no bad thing. It does seem to have come from an online petition, which was signed by 400,000 people. Isabel, in an attempt to sort of extrapolate a wider question from that, where do we draw the line in the modern age between actual people power or mob rule?
Oh, not a big question or anything, that, is
no,
it?
No, not really.
Look, I think that there has been a massive and, in my view, legitimate public reaction to the story of this dentist and his activities. His own practice seems to be in trouble.
A lot of one-star reviews turning up on Yelp, apparently.
I don't think that's mob rule. You know, mob rule is when somebody's going about their business peacefully and they get attacked by a mob for some normal activity. I think that's mob rule. I think that if you do something like this and you are discovered or exposed, there's a big reaction, and that's fair enough. And after all, airlines, they're certainly bandwagoning, but they know where the public mood is.
Yeah, it'd be interesting, actually. I mean, airlines are struggling anyway. It'd be interesting to know just how much they charge to transport the head of a rhinoceros back to the United States. And I mean this seriously. How much money are they losing by now stopping this sort of cargo on their aeroplanes?
My guess is not a lot.
Versus what are they gaining in free advertising from coming out against it?
Right, of course. One thing I would say, though, look, I'm obviously with Cecil here, but I do have to chuckle when I see huge images of Cecil the Lion in lights put up on the Empire State Building, and I just can't help thinking, look, okay, guys, you need to rein it in a little bit. I think we're pushing this a little bit too far.
I think it was one of those things that it touches a nerve because I think it's a relatively simple story in a very morally complicated world. And I agree with you. I think the reaction was excessive, possibly, and certainly sentimentally excessive. Possibly the thing that just stuck in my head was it wasn't, okay, it was the fact that the guy did this, which I think was a dreadful and bizarre thing to do, but he paid $55,000 to do it. And I was trying to think of that the other way. How much money would I want to be paid before I would consider doing something like that? It would be an extremely high figure. It's a really weird thing to spend that much money on.
Indeed. And who can explain why people do this? But I think that in terms of Cecil and his comrades, or indeed rhinoceri or elephants or any of the other tigers, any of the other creatures that are being steadily wiped out, they're not so much being wiped out by dentists with guns and large wallets. They're being wiped out by organised poaching gangs.
262 kilograms of elephant ivory was seized at Zurich en route from Dar es Salaam to Beijing this week.
And you've got to mention China, right?
You have to mention China. China's not the only destination, but of course it is the biggest place. And yes, it's the biggest destination, but all over Asia, that, you know, rhinoceros horn as an aphrodisiac. A lot of this seems to be about potency anxiety. Some of it's about ivory as a high prestige decorative object, and some of it is about traditional Chinese medicine. So I think if you really want to save the wildlife of Africa, maybe somehow we can read across from Cecil's fate into more convincing support and action against the gangs.
Isabel Hilton there, editor of China Dialogue, and Axel Threlfall, editor-at-large with Reuters, with Monocle's Andrew Muller on Tuesday's edition of Midori House. It's time now for a highlight from the Monocle Daily. We look now to the Arctic. Moscow has laid claim to more than 450,000 square miles of it recently, and it's quite a useful spot too. This particular patch is rich in oil, fish, and gas. Russia submitted its claim to the United Nations earlier this week. It's the second time it's tried. It failed 13 years ago. Not least because the US, Canada, Denmark, and Norway are also drawn to the Arctic. This is what Emma Nelson and Guy Delaney discussed with Thomas Lewis, Monocle's Toronto bureau chief.
The narrative will be that, you know, Russia wants to assert its influence. Now, we shouldn't forget that both Norway and Denmark have claims in already, and Canada is working on its own claim that it partially submitted in 2013, but is working on a fuller resolution for this part of the Arctic that will submit it to. So people will say that this is some sinister kind of move on the Russian part. I think it's actually doing things fairly by the book at the moment through the framework which the UN has laid out, and a lot of the commentary seems to have been in accordance with that too. But I think politically, especially here in Canada, which has just entered election season, the story might be quite different.
Why is that?
Well, I think it puts Prime Minister Stephen Harper in a fairly difficult position. Now, back at the Arctic Council meeting in Canada's Arctic North, there was a huge speculation of whether the Ukrainian issue would come up. Obviously, the Russians, the Americans, other European nations were all at the same table together, and Canada had just sent special forces, troops on the ground, if you like, to Ukraine to support pro-Kiev rebels there in a training capacity. Now, there was a lot of speculation whether Ukraine would be brought up, whether Russia would be confronted on its role there. That didn't happen in public, at least. And recently we've heard that the US delegation, which was led by Secretary of State John Kerry, actually sort of wagged its finger pretty angrily at Canada for even letting this boil up, for making it an issue at all. Now, I think, obviously, we're in election year now. Stephen Harper doesn't want to look like he's giving away possible Canadian territory, obviously, to the Russians, but equally he needs to sort of play by the international rules that the other members of the Arctic Council are playing by too. Now, of course, this is a very tight race here in Canada this year, and frankly, his opponents, the Liberal Party particularly, and the NDP, which seems to be doing very well in the polls at the moment, will basically seize on anything they can to try and get a political point on the Conservatives, whose future in government here is really up for grabs at the moment. So I think there's a very delicate balancing act, and it will become, I think, kind of a bit of a focus of the campaign, whether Prime Minister Harper likes it or not.
The
this region, the Arctic, Tom, it's obviously resource-rich, and that's going to be extremely controversial in terms of how those resources are exploited, managed, and, of course, who gets to profit and reap the benefits of them. But all these countries have agreed to go through a process about this 3 decades ago. What exactly is wrong with the status quo? Why does anybody have to be making claims? Why can't we just leave things as they are?
That's a very fair question. I think if you look back to 2013, when Sweden hosted the meeting of ministers at the Arctic Council, there was a real jubilant atmosphere that the Arctic was open for business. This was the next new unexplored territory that the rest of the world, the nations of the Arctic Council, could really benefit from, be it from energy, from the natural resources there, even from trade routes as the Arctic ice fades away. Now, in 2015, a couple of months ago, back in March, I think the mood was much, much quieter. The exploration that's taken place in the, say, 2 years since the meeting in Sweden has really shown that exploring the Arctic and getting its possible sort of resources from there is actually much tougher than anyone thought. Undoubtedly, there are resources to be tapped. I think the focus is actually shifting to renewable energy that the Arctic could actually yield up, rather than the traditional sources that lie there that are, as yet at least, untapped. So I think there is kind of a mood and a will, putting this, the Arctic shelf kind of issue to one side for a moment, for these nations to work together to try and get some of those resources up and running, and that might be actually the most positive role a developed Arctic, if you like, could play in the years to come.
Thomas Lewis there, Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief with Emma Nelson and Guy Delaney. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. A short break now, after which we hear why Pyongyang creates a new time zone all for itself, and also one view on how to fight Islamic State.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows, hosted right here at Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. Over to Syria now, where an American project to create a moderate fighting force to combat Islamic State militants has fallen on somewhat tough times. Last week, the force, called Division 30, came under attack. 10 fighters were abducted and 5 killed. Critics have noted the program is taking longer than expected. Barack Obama announced its creation last summer with the intention of training up to 5,000 fighters a year. Yet American defense officials claim they've had difficulty finding qualified recruits. On Thursday's edition of Midori House, Robert Fox, the defense editor of London's Evening Standard newspaper, spoke about the strength and rapid growth of IS in recent months and how unprepared Western governments are to deal with it.
Several things are becoming plain now. A, there is a major crisis of governance and credibility of governance right across the Arab world, but particularly from the Eastern Mediterranean into the Gulf. There are very basic loyalties that hold individuals or communities together, and they are community and tribe. In dynamics that a lot of the Western policymakers, who are tacticians rather than strategists, and often farmed out to private enterprises, private security outfits, simply don't stand a chance of getting anywhere near. And this is why I think part of the story that we understand, we by no means understand the whole story, of the evolution of ISIS is very interesting. And it's the members of the Ba'athist army of Iraq that were detained and ended up in places like Abu Ghraib and realized they were professional, they were fighters, there was going to be no take-up for them and no place for them for any kind of regime, puppet or otherwise, that was prepared or backed by the Western powers, whether in Baghdad or elsewhere, but principally in Baghdad. So they're moving away and they're still a center of attraction. Where I think, looking at it again and again, whatever you say about ISIS, yes, or IS, it isn't a state necessarily that you might expect in Liechtenstein or Luxembourg, and I'm not being facetious. We do seem to have this very Occidental model. But in the streets of Mosul or whatever, when they're digging drains, connecting power, trying to deliver some sort of welfare, they are, oh boy, some kind of state with terrifying sanctions by blood and vengeance, executions and so on, but they're there. And in the place of memory, lieu de mémoire, as the French call it, it's going to be very, very difficult to displace them. And I think that's one of the challenges that the Western powers, no Western government's representatives that I've come across, seems to be getting anywhere near grasping. They can identify it as a proposition, my proposition, but they can't engage with it in practical policy terms as to what you really do, except to add another 8 more Tornado aircraft or whatever. And this kind of thing is that what is being used in terms of hard power at the moment is barely little more than gestural.
Robert Fox there, defense editor of London's Evening Standard newspaper, on Thursday's edition of Midori House. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. North Korea has announced it's changing its time zone, turning all its clocks back by half an hour from August the 15th. The change will apparently rinse away all remnants of what it called wicked Japanese imperialists. When Korea was still one country, it was 8.5 hours ahead of GMT. That all changed in 1910, after Japan colonized the area. An official statement from Pyongyang said the decision to create a new time zone proved the unshakable faith and will of the service personnel and people on the 70th anniversary of Korea's liberation. Well, on Friday's edition of The Briefing, Tom Edwards spoke to Aidan Foster Carter, honorary senior research fellow in sociology and modern Korea at Leeds University, to hear more.
When you think probably they've scraped the barrel in every sphere to sort of show how different they are and how they're nobody's puppet and patsy and so on, they find something that we and perhaps until now they had forgotten. We are, of course, in Juche 104. I'm sure that in Midori House, very Japanese-sounding name that, by the way. Sorry, I'm trying to get into roll here. All the clocks, I'm sure that your calendars are set. You know it's Juche 104. They already, in other words, have a calendar, as far as years are concerned, in which year one, they don't do zero, was the year that their founding leader Kim Il-sung was born, 1912. But then there's this half hour, yes, and as you correctly said, Korea was, very briefly, I think, sort of an onset of modernity pre-Japanese, had its own time zone, half an hour different, half an hour between, as it were, China and Japan. And Japan changed that. The South Koreans actually did a similar nationalist thing in 1954, just after the Korean War. When Park Chung-hee, the dictator, the father of the South Korean president, who was elected, of course, came to power, he just changed it back to the Japanese one. Not, of course, because as a young man he'd served in the Japanese imperial forces, perish the thought, but because it's just so convenient to be on the same thing. These half hours, as people who are familiar with South Asia know, and I believe Nepal even has a quarter hour, they do make life a bit difficult. They seem to reverse the process spearheaded by U.S. railway companies in the 19th century, where we did try to at least have a single set of things. I guess we'll all know where we are, but it's typical, isn't it?
It is rather, Aidan. And I wonder, what's your take on how this actually plays, I guess, to the domestic audience consuming this sort of news within the borders of North Korea? Will there be a sort of a very proud resynchronizing of clocks and watches? What's the sort of impact on the home turf of these sorts of initiatives?
Good question. Always a difficult one, in a sense, quite what the North Korean people nowadays think of their government. It's harder to tell. I mean, given that a lot of them are watching at some risk, smuggled South Korean soaps and other stuff on the sly, so that even though they don't get to travel, they have some idea of how the outside world goes. I imagine there might be the odd quietly raised eyebrow here and there. Obviously, people will be quoted, I'm sure. People will, in that wonderful high-pitched voice that they all talk in public, they'll say, how passionate my heart is beating stronger for this. And you do get half an hour of your life over again, whether in North Korea, that's a great thing, I don't know. Do we know if they're doing it at midnight or what? In one practical awkwardness, there is still clinging on for dear life one South-North joint venture, the Kaesong Industrial Complex. It's in North Korea, it's just north of Seoul. The funny people actually commute across this otherwise uncrossable border. I guess because it's in North Korea and they make much of their sovereignty, that'll be on North Korean time. And I guess you adjust, don't say people in South Asia do. There's a joke, the Indians say that the Nepalis are always 50 minutes late for everything because they're 50 minutes behind. So that's the thing. I mean, you manage, don't you? Are there some US states that are on a half-hour thing too? But it clearly, it sort of goes the other way from the sort of homogenization of the world. Perhaps we should welcome it in that way, but I think it's a bit of a nuisance and absolutely typical. But at least it doesn't involve killing anybody, threatening anybody and so forth. If they want to just be peculiar, we'll let them.
Aidan Foster Carter there from Leeds University with Monocle's Tom Edwards. We're approaching the end of the program now, so it's time to hear one of our daily monologues. Let's stick with Tom Edwards. On Thursday, he put his own spin on how politicians' traits define them, and in doing so, influenced the lexicon. In fact, one might even say he was Edwardsing. Here's Tom.
The popularity of politicians can sometimes be a hard thing to understand. The high regard in which various blowhards, reprobates, and general ne'er-do-wells are held can be baffling. Conversely, many dedicated and honourable public servants can't even get the time of day from their electorate. It can be hard to know why. Charisma? Gravitas? Too much or too little of either? What makes a public official matter to people or not? One possible way to gauge the esteem in which a politician is held is to assess their impact on wider culture. Are they one of the lucky, relatively few to transcend their trade? It was interesting to read this week about an accolade of dubious sorts for Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel. Apparently, a new verb inspired by Frau Angela to merkeln could be the top pick in a poll of new words in popular usage amongst the country's youth. If you're engaged in some merkelning, basically you're being indecisive or non-committal, traits that Merkel's critics claim she has and displays in abundance. So to stay somewhere without really doing anything, as those German sceptics claim will be the case if Merkel does indeed bid for a fourth term, is to merkeln. Now this is public recognition, yes, but not necessarily quite the right sort. But in politics, is all publicity good publicity? To test the efficacy of this cliché, perhaps it's worth trying out some other new verbs inspired by current and recent ranks of global leaders. To Silvio. This verb of Italian extraction is a handy catch-all for pretty much every transgression and misdemeanour you can rustle up in public life. To Hollande. The arrival for or flight from nefarious or extramarital activity by motorised scooter. A popular move among philanderers, eager to conceal their identity using a crash helmet. To Trump, a rediscovered gem, formerly suggestive of a lavishly toupeed indifference with regard to everyday people's problems, now redeployed as byword for mildly to strongly offensive nationalism, unsavoury political opportunism, and lavishly toupeed indifference to the general public. Finally, to Putin. To steamroller things, ideas, political rivals, small nations, by force or threat of said, whilst engaging in distraction tactics such as nude fishing or bear wrestling. This is merely a flavour of the lexicographical options available for some of the globe's most prominent figures. Maybe given some of the excesses to which I allude, Frau Merkel should be fairly happy with a mere spot of merkelning. And perhaps that's the true gauge of political popularity. If you're lampooned by your critics for not doing very much, as Angela Merkel has been, then the chances are that history will judge you rather more kindly than the miscreants who've spent their years in high office Silvioing, Trumping and Putining their way from one embarrassment to another. For Monocle, I'm Tom Edwards.
And that's all we've got time for in this week's episode of The Recap. This show is produced by Marcus Hippie and edited by Weidong Lin. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Daniel Giacopelli, thanks for listening. Goodbye.